Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Now, you've been hearing a lot about a program that's going to be at Memorial Hall on Thursday and Friday. It's called The End of Cinematics. And it conjures up all kinds of images, and maybe you've heard some of the descriptive literature about it. It's a provocative, it's experimental. It uses multimedia. It celebrates and mourns, I think, our relationship with the movies. But here as I talk, I realize I don't understand a word of what I'm saying.
You're doing so pretty well, D.G.
Emil Kang, the czar of the arts in Chapel Hill, has brought this production to us. And Emil, you've seen this production. Why? What grabbed you about it that make you know that this was right for Chapel Hill at this time?
Well, I think we have to begin by putting it into context of our entire series. You know, I think we pride ourselves with bringing a diverse array of artists from all walks of life, from Lyle Lovett to The End of Cinematics. The two couldn't be more different, but equally, I believe, important. And in many ways, the art form, multimedia art, is in a sense a new wave. And what we're trying to do is to present the cutting-edge innovative artists from around the world who present their ideas through this new medium. In many ways, it's just when the electric guitar was developed, that was new, brand new then. Multimedia is brand new now. And so it has a soundtrack, in a sense, behind it of music that is very accessible. So while the multimedia component might seem, in some respects, imposing, the music is very much Beatles-esque.
Well, let me do this for me.
Yes.
When you came home from this production, and the first person, let's just say it was Lisa Kang, first person you
actually it was Steve Allred.
It was Steve Allred that you talked to about it.
Because he saw it with me.
He said, "All right, well, what did y'all say? What did you all? Not what you said to each other at first. We might get to that, but what
to ourselves.
What did you say when you were trying to explain it to someone like me that what you saw? What was it?
It really was like going to the movies, but in a multisensory way.
You know, many, it's like 3D.
In many ways, going to the movies is very, very one-dimensional and very passive, of course. And this experience begins, actually, when you walk into the Memorial Hall. It will begin when you walk into the lobby, and that's all I can say now. I don't want to ruin any surprises.
All right, that's going to be a surprise, but okay.
But basically, what he's trying to recreate is the experience of going to the movies. He's trying to, in many ways, set up the audience in a way that might be comfortable for them, and then to disturb that comfort a little bit by presenting live music, actors, video projections, some film footage, and I think most importantly, maybe in all of this, a message of the society we live in today, and maybe in you're saying mourning or lamenting the decay of cinema as an art form and the overt commercialization of movie making today. And also, I think, in terms of the soundbite culture we live in and our inability to actually pay attention to anything for more than 2 minutes, I think in many ways, as you'll see in seeing the work, it's really it's a barrage of ideas and images and sounds, and it's actually very beautiful. And I say that carefully. It's not beautiful in the sense of a beautiful meadow with pretty flowers in that sense, but it's beautiful in its artistic inception. The musical soundtrack, it fits very nicely with the images we see. It was developed at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for the Krannert Center of the Performing Arts, our counterpart over there, and with the Center for Supercomputing Applications. They had to develop new technology to do what Michael was envisioning, because what happened was they took film footage that they shot and that they stock footage they got, and removed some of the characters and actually placed them on the stage live. And in many ways, you think you're not sure if you're really seeing what you're seeing.
So, I'm trying to pull out of this what you saw when you saw it. And one of the things that you saw, there'll be a question mark at the end of the statement. One of the things you saw was a person who was real, but the backdrop was a film, and he had been in the... I mean, so it looks like you're seeing a film and a real person
together?
Well, actually,
there are about seven or eight performers on stage, about six screens of video images going. So you see, and there are multi layers of these sets, backgrounds. There are scrims, four video projection screens, and this very, very overwhelming musical soundtrack that's over the entire thing. But you know, we left it with when the work ended, it was wow. That was the first reaction. Oh my God. Second reaction. Third reaction. And in many ways, you start to digest what you've just experienced. And you don't listen to it, you don't watch it, you experience it. Because it really is very multisensory. And so you think, okay, so now what do I think of the work? And there are many things to comment on. The idea that we live in this kind of society that I mentioned earlier, or the use of technology, or the quality of his music, because he wrote, directed, conceived everything about this piece. So you can comment on it in many different ways and dissect it as many ways as you want, or you can just let it sort of just sit with you.
Let me ask you this. If it's going to be neither of these, but let's just say I went to see or went to hear the symphony,
mm-hmm.
or I went to see a movie
right.
on a screen.
Right.
And if I went to see a movie, I'd see some kind of story. If I went to the symphony, there might be some kind of story wrapped up in there, but essentially I'd just be experiencing this moment of...
With a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah, and of beauty and of, I don't know, sensuousness mm-hmm. of some sort. Now, is the end of cinematics, is it closer to the symphony or closer to the movie? Is there a story involved?
No, it is not. It's a non-narrative, which I think for many ways is going to be the most difficult part for our audiences, because people, they like to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, because they want to take a journey. And that's not wrong. I mean, that's right. But in this respect, he's trying to comment on our need for that and how all movies are about that.
Let me just put in a third thing as to see which is... Or is it closer to a fireworks display on the 4th of July at Keenan Stadium, where it's just lots of action going on without an apparent connective link?
I can see how you would suggest that. I think
I'm trying.
I'm not being critical. I think it's that in some respects you could say that, but I think the meaning of it is a lot deeper. And but again, I don't want to get hoity-toity about it, because it's the work. He wouldn't want you to think it that way.
What do you mean he wouldn't want
to? He's really trying to comment on today's society, and it's not meant to be out of this world or weird. And trust me, I've been to a lot more symphony concerts that I thought were weirder than this work will be. Because there are contemporary composers on this planet that write works for orchestras that are very strange. And this is going to be a lot more accessible than that.
Well, let me just throw in some. Is it closer to a visit to the Acklin, where there is a series, Acklin Art, or to a museum that had an art exhibit that had a theme to it, and you experienced all these things visually?
I think it's closer to going to a museum that had no real apparent arrangement of the paintings. And you had no acoustic guide to listen to.
Well,
that's kind of what it was.
Well, then, Emil, again, I'm learning about this. And what frightens me about engaging in this experience is that you're kind of throwing me into a place where a whole bunch of things are going to be happening. I don't know what's going on. I don't have a guidebook, and I'm not sure I can grasp the meaning.
And we actually anticipate that, so we're actually holding a symposium. I'm not sure, DJ, if I told you this, actually, at the Carolina Inn on Friday night at 5 o'clock with Michael Rouse there, and also with Dan Reed, the Vice Chancellor for Information Technology, who actually was at University of Illinois at the Center for Supercomputing Applications, with Larry Grossberg from the university, with... Joyce Rudinsky from Comm Studies, one professor from French Studies, because there are lots of scenes of France, of Paris in this project, and then the critic from The Village Voice in New York, who is a huge fan of Michael's music. I should say that End of Cinematics, after it leaves us, it's going to Brooklyn, to the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It's actually opening the Next Wave Festival. Some of you might, some of the audiences might know that the Next Wave Festival is probably one of the most respected contemporary music festivals in the world.
Well, Emil Kang, we need to take a quick break. We're talking about the upcoming production, The End of Cinematics. And Emil, you're helping me understand why you're so excited about this. And we'll talk some more about it after this break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Emil Kang and I are talking about The End of Cinematics, and why is Emil Kang telling me about it? He's the guy who decided, with approvals, the proper approvals, that this production would come to Chapel Hill. And Emil, so far you told me that this is an imaginative work. It's something like nothing we've ever seen.
Right.
It is on the cutting edge.
Right.
And I wonder if, I mean, is part of this is that you're trying to help holding our hands, bring Chapel Hill into the 21st century by bringing us the non-standard kind of events? And is this one of those?
I think it's more that we're trying to present all viewpoints of the arts. Again, as I said earlier, from very traditional American roots musicians like Ralph Stanley, all the way to this End of Cinematics. All art has its place, I think, in our society, and what we're trying to demonstrate is that there is a very wide variety, and all of it has its place, and all of it is justified and valued and valid. And we believe that we're not serving our community, especially if we are considering ourselves a very sophisticated community, if we don't present all sides of that art picture. And so at the end of the day, though, I think that it's innovation that's going to drive us forward. Innovation in scientific research, innovation in scholarship, innovation in medicine, and also in the arts. And we believe there is a very important role that innovative new work has in moving us forward, in developing the new standards for art making and art experiencing for the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. At some point, every form of art is new. And if we're always reflecting on the past 200 years, we're never looking either at the current time or to the future. Not everything we present will last, and that I think the staying power is a true test of its success and its validity and value. And only time will tell. But again, if we don't take those risks, we're never going to know.
So you might say to me, D.G., come see this. We want you to enjoy Lyle Lovett and the wonderful music, and we mm-hmm. want you to enjoy the symphony. And now we want to show you what performing arts might be like, more like 50 years from now or 25 years from now, when we're comfortable taking advantage of all the technological assets that are available to us in performing.
You know, in some ways, you could say that. I'm not suggesting that he's sort of like RoboCop from the future. That might not be the best example, but I think you know what I mean. It's really about, even in today's standard, Lyle Lovett is creating new music today, and Michael Rouse is creating new music today. Ralph Stanley I'm not so sure about, but it's still all new to them. But they happen to actually use very different media, mm-hmm. and that's sort of the point. But sometimes certain media take a longer time for it to become more mainstream. Of course, there are some artists in every field that once they become mainstream, abandon that because that's not what they want. And I'm not sure if Michael's in that category, though.
This is not a concert. It's based, you say he, everybody's it's, saying this guy is a great writer of music. I mean, or a great composer of music.
And has great aesthetic. And
So yeah. that even if you're not engaged with the imaginative excitement,
visuals,
is the music good enough just on its own to come here?
I think so.
And how is the music presented?
It's presented as a straight soundtrack behind it, much like you see in the movies. iTunes, you can download the music. It actually began as an album first and then became this, what sometimes I call a pop opera. It became that afterwards. So the music is available for everyone to listen to, and people could actually, you know, memorize it before they come to the performance. And I think it was Steve Allred, our executive associate provost, who came to the performance with me, went to it with me at UC Davis, who said it reminded him of the Beatles' Revolver album. And Michael acknowledged that, Michael Rouse. So, you know, and you know, obviously Steve was pleased to know that that he hit something with that, and that, and you know, that anyone can actually experience it in their own way, and it would be valid. So I think in some respects, attending the symposium Friday night before the performance would be helpful because of all these people there. There'll be post-performance Q&As from the stage as well. So people who have questions after they see it can actually ask them of Michael.
Emil, just on details, tell us about tickets and about the various places that the symposium and the performances are going to be. And if you will, a little bit about cost, if you've
sure.
got that handy.
The tickets range from $30 to $60. UNC students, of course, get in for $10. And they can be purchased online on our website at carolinaperformingarts.org or at 843-3333 or at in person at our box office at Memorial Hall. The symposium is being run by the Friday Center, and I need to just shout out, as they say, to the Friday Center because they've been terrific. Their professional development and enrichment programs, they're the ones presenting the symposium and put this together. Megan Barr, in particular, really made this happen. And you can actually go on the Friday Center website and purchase tickets there for the symposium. And they are $100 for dinner, the symposium, and the concert ticket, and parking, which I think is a fairly good deal for all of that.
Well,
so that's, I guess, how you would go about getting all of that.
You've been talking. Thank you very much. But main thing is if you call the number at Memorial Hall.
843-3333. You can get information on everything.
Get information on all of it. I think that you've mentioned this guy's name several times already, but Michael Rouse.
Michael Rouse.
Is the composer.
The composer, the conceiver,
producer.
The director, producer.
And is he a performer as well?
He's a performer. He sings on stage. He acts on stage. You'll see him.
And tell us about him.
He's very impressive. Very New York. Wears a lot of black. Young guy in his 40s, and is just fun to be with. He's the kind of guy you'll spend in a bar drinking for hours and just talking about many things.
Has he won a lot of medals? Has he got a reputation, or is he someone that you just say this is his principal accomplishment so far?
I don't think he would measure his success by number of medals. I think he's much more interested in pushing artistic boundaries, and so this is what you see. But it's also rare to find one person who really does present his or her own vision at this scale. Usually there's a director, there's a producer, there's a lighting designer, there's a da da da, and he is the central person. And I think in many ways that's why this work can succeed, because it actually stays true to what he envisions it to be.
Is it similar to Lyle Lovett in the sense that while the Lyle Lovett concert the other night, Lyle Lovett was the central character,
right.
The conceiver, supported by a large cast of wonderful people to whom he gave a lot of credit.
Right.
All of them, that he was the sun and they were the planets and constellation around him. And is this Michael Rouse's?
That solar system analogy, I think, makes sense in many ways. It's his vision. People that you're going not just to see him, though. It's different than Lyle in that you're going to see Lyle. You're going actually here to see the end of cinematics, which happens to be written and directed by Michael Rouse, which also happens to feature him. But it's really more about the work itself. And again, I think that's my opinion. Michael might differ, disagree with me, but I think that's what he intends, which is very different than, of course, Lyle Lovett and hearing him sing.
Are there any other stars?
They're all very talented artists, actors, musicians, but, I mean, household names, of course not, no. I should also say that the work, we're co-commissioning this work. And why that's important is that the work is being presented because of our sponsorship resources of it. In it, and we're co-sponsoring, co-commissioning this with the University of Illinois, as I mentioned.
Well, now, you've already seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's already done.
Right.
How can you be a co-commissioner?
When we first saw it, it was still in its stages of finalization, and the costs of actually moving this around are huge. And so there would be no way for it to travel to different places on a traditional touring kind of budget. We're renting a projector, for example, that costs to rent, just a projector, one projector, $1,000 a day. And we're renting it for 8 days. It seems a little crazy. But the projector, the equipment is very, very sophisticated. Much of it comes from New York. And, you know, the production cost alone is going to really be very expensive.
I don't mean to belabor this at all, but this is the cost of the production of the play here in Chapel, or the performance here in Chapel Hill, and I don't understand why that makes you a co-creator.
Because taking the work on the road is a separate cost than presenting it in Chapel Hill.
And I see.
That cost alone, remounting work, of reassembling staff together is a whole different thing. And you also hope that the artist ends up with some change when it's all done, said and done.
So that it's not set in stone now. It's still evolves. Being monkeyed with, I guess you'd say.
I would say most new work evolves. And every place it's going to be different. You see some things get changed. I mean, as you, DG, know from first-hand experience, being part of Mycenaean with Carl Rux, that work wasn't brand new. And yet, I probably thought that it felt like it was brand new because he was changing it as he was going. And so, in that sense,
in response to my performance,
absolutely.
Well, we're getting off topic a little bit, but it's really Emil Kang is helping me understand better the reasons why the End of Cinematics is not only thought provoking and provocative, but might well be worth experiencing. We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin, Emil Kang, and I are talking about the End of Cinematics, which the Memorial Hall will be presenting on Thursday night and Friday night. Is that right?
The 28th and 29th.
29th. You mentioned that you're renting a camera at $1,000 a day.
Projector.
A projector for 8 days. Why do you need it for 8 days?
Because the load-in begins on Sunday.
Load-in,
it means when the technicians, the crew, the cast, the staff begin to arrive to set up the stage. This is the first production that's going to take this long to mount because of its complexity, both technologically and in terms of sheer quantity of stuff. We're hanging things from the lighting cove right above our Lux Libertas seal for the first time. We're having to use physics to measure balancing weights and things like that for the first time. This is really going to stretch us, but I think for the good, because it just makes our crew better. As well.
Emil, economically, this has got to be a challenge in the sense that you're pushing the envelope in terms not just technologically, but also in terms of the what your regular audience is
right.
ready for yet,
right.
and
right.
so that the you can't expect
a sold-out house
to make as much. You can't expect maybe a sold-out house or to make as much money as you would on something that's tried and true.
I love it. Right.
And so what thought process do you go through as you balance the need to, you know, fill the tills versus the need to educate, enlighten, expand
push
your
the
audience?
Boundaries, yeah. Fortunately, we don't evaluate everything individually because if we did, it would be impossible to bring this work. So we look at the entire season and we look at the array of artists we have and a projection in revenue and a projection in expenses. And we monkey with that until it balances properly out to the numbers we need it to be at. So some are more profitable. Profitable is a very funny word because it's not profit in the sense that we make money. We don't make money on anything. As people probably know, ticket sales only covers about 40% of our total expenses on any performance. So because typically the more popular they are, the more expensive they are. It's just there is a correlation there. But we present work like this even though it loses money, these are economically not viable, which is why they need support. But we believe this is why we need to be pushing this, because we believe part of our responsibility. This is what I call a mission production. We're doing it for mission reasons, not necessarily for economic reasons.
Well, I'm just imagining, I can't put myself in your shoes, but I'm imagining that you walk across campus and around places, and most people kind of are looking aside because they don't understand what's going on here.
Right.
And then every now and then you run into somebody who does understand it.
Right.
And they just throw their arms around you and say, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Right.
I mean,
that's true.
What kinds of people have experienced this and are really excited about it?
Our students. It's so funny to me is that the greatest number of audience members that really are thrilled with the work that, and it's in particular our Urban Voices series, but in the other more cutting edge work, our students love it because it speaks to them. It's not, again, a very traditional art form. It's art form that they can relate to. So whether it's with Carl Rux or it's with DJ Spooky, who, if you remember, presented Rebirth of a Nation, but did it with remixing video, or with the End of Cinematics, it's much more related to them. And yet, all the way through all of these things, there is an actual social context. And for us, the medium is less important than the context. And we want to be sure that whatever art we present has a context that is meaningful to our community. So for, I believe, again, the importance of this discussion of living in a soundbite culture, of the decay of cinema, these are things we should be talking about. And just similarly, talking about issues of race and discrimination, and in D.W. Griffith's film, is an important thing to talk about. And in many ways, the Urban Voices artists actually, it's kind of ironic, I think, present more cogent and relevant arguments on social issues of today than do the more traditional artists of classical and bluegrass artists do. So that's arguable, of course, but that's what I think. And I think our students actually get that. More than most.
More than people my age who have a firmer fixed idea based on their growing up about what they expect in a performance.
Especially if they view it as entertainment or if they view it as something that should sound nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Although I would argue this in a cinematic sounds nice. And the other group of people that actually really like this are our faculty members. We have a lot of faculty who towards the end of last year just wrote thank you notes to us and said, thank you, not just for presenting a season, but a season that was courageous and bold. And they were referring to all things, like Tall Horse, if you remember the puppets from Africa. That was equally as courageous, the courageous might be overly dramatic, but bold as presenting DJ Spooky. But they're very different. Seeing puppets is fairly accessible. Watching this D.W. Griffith's film with video projections over it is not as accessible. So we're fortunate to have lots of faculty members who actually appreciate this because, again, what we're doing is we're trying to create a home for the arts that happens to be in Chapel Hill, but we also want to become a center for the arts globally. I mean, we talk about wanting the arts as popular and important as Carolina basketball. I've been mocked for that many times. But we want.
What do you mean? No. It's a great. No, if, only in. If anybody's teasing you about that, they appreciate that. That's the kind of ambition everybody around here likes, I think.
And that, for me, that began during my interview. That's what I said it during my open forum, and it's never been lived down. But it's an easy thing for people to understand. The vision is clear. And I really believe this is a central part or central ingredient in making that happen.
Well, a lot of people, who don't. Go to Cat's Cradle.
Right.
Really like the idea that this speaks out that this kind of innovative, exciting work that maybe I might not appreciate, but we love the idea that innovators are around us.
Right, exactly. That's a good point.
So maybe some people would celebrate and say, okay, you still hadn't convinced me, DG, that I want to go see the End of Cinematics. You hadn't given it to me. But I sure am glad it's there. You know, I'm glad that we're doing this kind of thing.
And to be quite frank, DG, I would consider that a success. Because I'm a firm believer that not all art is for me either. But I would believe that it has its place. And we should, as art, in a sense, art impresarios, be presenting all views and not just take a one-sided view on things. For example, I'm not a big fan of 12-tone music. but I believe academically it's an important period of composition to share with our students and our community. And there are some very distinguished composers who wrote in that style. But that doesn't mean I would buy a ticket to go see a concert. Not on your life. But it's important to do. So I appreciate what you said, because I think that's an important point to mention. We're not necessarily trying to create everyone to want to come. We want everyone to value it, though, and value it and its place in our community.
Well, one of the things that I think is that you pointed out to me that's real important is that the End of Cinematics does have a message, that it provokes conversation. But what I haven't been able to do is to get you to have some of that conversation with me about what kinds of what was its message to you, and what has carried with you after, you know, since you've seen it. What are some of the things that we might expect to be wrestling with in a stronger way that after the performance than we're wrestling with now?
Right. Again, this would be then Emil Kang, the audience member.
Right. This is what I want.
Yeah, which is very different.
You're not
the presenter.
And you're not going to prejudice what my reaction will be.
Right.
But I think it will be informed by, and I'll be excited by what if you really did get excited about it.
And what I like to do is share this with others after they've seen it.
I understand this.
Before, because
but pretend that I'm a skeptic who doesn't believe you were really excited. Prove it to me by telling me what you got.
Hopefully you've gotten that from the word of everything I've said up to this point. No, I'm kidding.
I believe that you're excited, but I got to know.
I will. I'll say this. Some of the artists we've been presenting, including Michael Rouse, have been really conveying to me as an audience member this notion that we're living in a more and more of a passive society, and believe that we're being treated some way, badly or well, whatever your political views are, by governments, by the corporate world, by these so-called leaders of our country. And what these artists are saying to all of us is that, you know, heck, you know, if you have an opinion, do something about it. Don't just sit there, watch the news on TV at 6 o'clock and think you can complain. Because there is a passive acceptance to it that you're doing. That is our message I agree with. And I think is interesting to have a conversation about. Because I believe there's some truth to that. And you could dissect that a million different ways, of course. Secondly, movies. You know, I'll be the first person to tell you, I went to see Mission Impossible 1, 2, and 3. But you know what? Do I remember anything like 10 minutes after I leave? No. I forget it completely.
All this pizzazz and
it's gone out of my mind. All I remember was, okay, I spent $9 and the popcorn cost me $4. Jeez. That's right. I'm joking, but I completely forget, except that I know Tom Cruise was in it, but that's all I remember. And for me, though, other films that are much more March of the Penguins, even. They don't the film by Al Gore, which I'm forgetting the name of now. So documentaries today have really, in many ways, come into our lives and are providing us things that the commercial movies aren't giving us anymore. They weren't as popular before because we had more foreign films and art films, and sometimes those are still at the fringes, and that's why I think Full Frame does so well for that reason, because we are seeking interpretations of real life. And we know that movie making is certainly nowhere near real life. But, you know, one can argue you want to get away. You want to live in a fantasy for 2 hours. But I think there are ways to do that better with
God, well, this is great.
Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I got to take a break. But sure. I hate to interrupt this. Emil Kang and I are talking about the End of Cinematics, which is a Memorial Hall production this Thursday and Friday evenings. And he's got me persuaded it's not to be missed. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Emil Kang is the executive director of the arts czar at Chapel Hill, sure. And he is responsible after seeing the End of Cinematics in an earlier production, of getting excited about bringing it to Chapel Hill, and we understand your excitement, Emil. and you shared with us one of the messages that you came out with was an excitement about, gosh, we're passive. We we just sit around and don't eat anything. And it brought back the image of one of your concerts recently. I guess this is Love It. But here we were, I mean, you know, a fantastic performance, and we were all thousands of us sitting there. And I saw three or four of these great younger women in their seats, and they were just, you know, it was like they wanted to be out of their seats so much, and they were almost dancing in the seats. They were so involved in the performance, yeah. But they were confined to their seating.
By our culture and by this what they think Memorial Hall is. And that's, in many ways, it concerns me, because the theater should be a place for people to experience things individually. And yet there is a group mentality that infects everyone. In fact, in many ways, I'm teaching a first-year seminar this year with Madeline Grumet, and we're actually having our students, these freshmen who are fabulous, by the way, actually look at the role of the audience to the artist and how these audience members have an effect on artists. If you go to any major rock concert, in the first four rows, they're always saved for members of the fan club, because they know they'll be the most rabid fans and therefore will be the craziest on the stage and therefore really energize the artist. What would happen if you went to a Rolling Stones concert in the first four rows? They were just sitting there staring into space.
You had the wine and cheese crowd,
right,
there.
That wouldn't work for anybody. And I'm sure the Stones would feel depressed about that. And it would really sap, I think, energy out of them.
So for the rest of the audience, that even those who are not participating as much, the first four rows with the real fans become part of the performance.
I mean, absolutely, they do, right? Because you're mentioning you enjoyed seeing these three young girls dance.
Yeah.
That, I'm sure, contributed to your enjoyment.
I didn't even think about it, but it enhanced my enjoyment of the concert. And the other analogy is that you like to raise Carolina basketball. 8 or 10 years ago, somebody said, we got all the rich people down there in front, and they just sit there.
Right.
And let's get some kids. And somebody was able, man, I don't know who, to wrench out a few seats to put the most passionate kids down there. And it's not only arguably helped the basketball team to have that kind of support, but it's enhanced the enjoyment of the remaining rich people down there on the front row.
Well, it sure makes me feel better. I mean, those kids don't sit for a second. They stand the entire time.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the opposing team throws foul shots, you just love it when they're waving their little balloons. It's just the most wonderful thing in the world.
Well, it was hard to get those first four rows, first eight rows or whatever it is, over on the sides for the kids. Now, I wonder, can you tear up the first eight rows of Memorial Hall and make it available for the standing crowd who will be the most enthusiastic supporters of whatever performer you've got there? And would you like to do that?
Well, typically, you know, we actually add orchestra pit seating at the last minute. And we can't know that until the artist comes and looks at the stage, and then they decide whether they want to allow the pit to be lowered and for us to put seats on them. Nickel Creek and Lyle Lovett both allowed us to do that, but we had to sell those tickets at the last minute. And again, savvy patrons know that when things are sold out, they should call on the day of, and a whole block of tickets might come out again because we've just decided to sell pit seats, and there we have about up to 28 there. And, you know, sometimes you hit or miss. You might get the right people there, you might not. And we had some for Nickel Creek, the performance last Tuesday, we had a really great, great crowd. I mean, there were students of all kinds just screaming and yelling, I love you, you're the best, marry me, those kinds of things you hear at rock concerts. But it made me smile. I love that. And it would have been a lot different if none of those things were said.
What about getting back to the end of cinematics? Is this, now this is, from your personal viewpoint, was sort of a stab at the passivity.
Yeah,
but
I
now, will the audience be encouraged to get up and sing, or are they going to be passive?
No, it doesn't do anything, but it knows the audience will be passive. So if one audience member now listening to the show, DG, decides to stand up and scream in the middle of it, that would probably interrupt things.
Don't encourage me.
I'm not going to, yeah. But, you know, there are some artists who would love that, and there are some artists who wouldn't like that so much.
So this artist, in criticizing passivity, would resent the lack of passivity in the reaction.
Well, no, I have no idea, because I think that you'd have to ask him.
Yeah, that's too far. Yeah. That's taking it too far. In any event, what you brought to us, and thanks for explaining it, you're bringing to us a provocative piece, one which stretches the boundaries of what maybe some of us are used to in Chapel Hill, and you celebrate that.
Right, but I think it stretches the boundaries in terms of maybe delivery, but I believe the subject matter speaks to all of us. And I think that is not at all alien to any of us. The subject matter of the of passivity in society, of the cinema today, all those things. Those things everyone on the street can relate to.
One of the promotional pieces says, if you love the movies, you ought to go to this. Is that right? I mean, if you love the
movies, obviously you're it's a bit of a hook as well, because again, I can't divulge any secrets. But when you walk into the lobby, that's when the performance actually will begin, not when you sit down in your seat.
All right,
I'll leave it at that.
Check and see. Miguel Kang telling us about the In the Cinemax, the production at Memorial Hall on this Thursday and this Friday. And thanks to you very much. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate it, and I'll be back same time tomorrow.